This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, February 26, 2008. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I know some of my colleagues don't want to be talking about Iraq again.
In today's program, Senate Republicans allow debate on Democratic plans to withdraw troops from Iraq.
We wanted to remind the American people that we still take this very seriously. We still have 160,000 American soldiers with lives at risk, and we've lost almost 4,000.
A House Judiciary Subcommittee votes to subpoena the former Ohio Secretary of State about voter suppression.
It seems to me in recent years, instead of promoting access to the polls, the voting section of the Department of Justice seems to have used its enforcement authority to deny access.
And Democratic Burmese activists flee the country's interior for the border with Thailand. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. After more than a decade's delay, the United States Senate today passed a bill modernizing the health care system for Native Americans. Yin Messier reports from Capitol Hill.
The Indian Health Care Improvement Act passed the Senate by an overwhelming margin.
With 83 voting in the affirmative and 10 voting in the negative, S-1200 as amendment is agreed to.
The health care system for Native Americans has not been updated since 1992. Funding is provided annually and lags behind population growth and inflation. Tribal clinics often have to ration care and treat only the most urgent cases. The updated bill would authorize $16 billion for Indian health programs over the next 5 years and $35 billion over the next 10. North Dakota Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan is chairman of the Indian Affairs Committee and principal author of the bill.
It's been a long time coming, 16 years, but finally we made progress. And this progress, I believe, will save lives.
A similar bill has been introduced in the House, but it's still waiting for action. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ye Meixie on Capitol Hill.
A tribunal in Nigeria has upheld the election of President Yar'Adua. Sam Olukoya is in Lagos.
The tribunal, seated in the federal capital of Abuja, rejected petitions by the presidential candidates of the two main opposition parties claiming fraud and vote rigging during the election that brought President Yar'Adua to power. The tribunal said there was no evidence that the violations of the electoral law were substantial enough to invalidate the election result. While President Yar'Adua's ruling People's Democratic Party hailed the verdict, the opposition says it will appeal. The appeal will be heard by the Supreme Court, which will have the final say on the matter. International and local election monitors observed that the election conducted in April last year and concluded it was deeply flawed. Election tribunals have removed about 50 elected officials, including 7 state governors and the Senate president. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
The United Auto Workers Union has gone on strike against American Axle. The strike, the third called by the union against a U.S. automotive company in the last 6 months, began just after midnight as a 4-year contract expired. At issue is the company's call for significant reductions in wages and benefits. The walkout affects some 3,600 workers and has shut down American Axle plants in Michigan and in New York. The Kurdish PKK, or Kurdistan Workers' Party, resumed fighting last night as a response to attacks that began on Thursday. Hiba Dawood has more.
The Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK, is a Kurdish guerrilla group the Turkish government accuses of attacking Turkey from the Iraqi border. Today, the PKK announced an attack in El Zab area along the border between Kurdistan and Turkey that resulted in the death of 21 soldiers. They also said the PKK still has 5 of the Turkish soldiers' dead bodies. 1 PKK soldier was killed and 2 were injured. PKK officials say that the Turkish forces have partially withdrawn but continue fighting on 2 fronts. PKK spokesperson Rose Willat says that the Turkish situation is difficult due to the strong resistance they are confronted with from the PKK. They expect a military escalation from the Turk side will likely resume as a part of a bigger operation. Thousands of people rallied in the southeastern city of Diyarbakir against Turkey's ground operation. The pro-Kurdish party, DTP, who organized the rally, made a statement calling Turkey to end the operation. This is Hibe Dawood for FSRN.
A vault carved into the Arctic permafrost and filled with samples of the world's most important seeds was inaugurated today, aimed at safeguarding biodiversity in the face of climate change, wars, and other natural and man-made disasters. The new seed bank in Norway has the capacity to hold up to 4.5 million batches of seeds. That's twice the number of crop varieties believed to exist in the world today. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
A day after anti-war groups launched a multi-million dollar campaign to highlight the cost of the war, Senate Republicans have agreed to consider measures that would diminish the U.S.'s troop presence in Iraq. But Republicans are not necessarily interested in actual troop withdrawal. They say they will allow the debate so they can highlight the successes U.S. forces have had in the country. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, has led the Senate in opposition to the war in Iraq. He took to the Senate floor Tuesday two pieces of legislation that would alter U.S. military engagement there.
I know some of my colleagues don't want to be talking about Iraq again. I know some of them complain that we spent too much time debating Iraq last year, and I know some of them have concerns about whether now is the right time to bring up these bills for a vote. Mr. President, we cannot allow the focus on Iraq to fade because violence has declined in parts of Iraq. It is true that violence levels are down to where they were in 2005. But as you all know, Iraq is still extremely and unacceptably violent as it was in 2005. Violence has risen in Mosul and in the south. And U.S. casualty rates in January were actually higher than in December. All is not calm in Iraq. All is not calm in Iraq as the administration would have you believe.
One of Feingold's measures is a non-binding resolution that says funding for combat missions in Iraq be stopped within 6 months. The other would transfer resources from Iraq and expand military operations in Afghanistan. Republicans allowed the debate to proceed because they say they will highlight progress in Iraq. Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
This will be the 35th Iraq vote we've had since the new majorities have taken over. We've spent a lot of time discussing Iraq over the last year. During much of that time, the view of what was happening in Iraq was not nearly as positive or optimistic as it is now.
As Assistant Republican Leader John Kyle says, the Republicans will try to point out the Democrats in a negative light by bringing attention to issues not being debated, like expired surveillance legislation that is currently stalled in Congress.
That's what we'd ought to be focused on rather than yet another debate about Iraq. But if Democrats wish to have that debate, Republicans will be happy to oblige. They won't have the support of the Republicans.
Democrats argue they want to keep a failed war front and center. Assistant Democratic Leader Richard Durbin.
But we wanted to remind the American people that we still take this very seriously. We still have 160,000 American soldiers with lives at risk, and we've lost almost 4,000. And we think that it just is unfair for anyone to argue that we can do nothing and shouldn't even try to do anything. We're going to try our best, and I hope some Republicans will cross the aisle and join us.
MoveOn.org, the Center for American Progress, the SEIU, VoteVets.org, and other groups have launched advertisements to highlight the costs of war. The ads during this election year will also highlight likely Republican presidential nominee Senator John McCain and his support for a continued U.S. troop presence in Iraq. McCain was not present at the vote. Neither were Democratic opponents, Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Both were preparing for Tuesday night's debate in Ohio. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Today, the House Judiciary Committee held an oversight hearing on voter suppression. Notably missing from the testimony was that of Kenneth Blackwell, the former Ohio Secretary of State. He oversaw Ohio's 2004 presidential elections and the ensuing charges of widespread voter disenfranchisement. Democratic Congressmen John Conyers and Gerald Nadler asked Blackwell to testify, but were reportedly turned down. Now the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties has voted to allow Conyers to issue Blackwell a subpoena. Naji Mujahid has more from Washington.
The topic for discussion at the Judiciary Subcommittee on Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties was voter suppression in the electoral process, and more specifically, the Justice Department's responsibility to protect those rights. Over the past few years, the DOJ has devoted much of its energies towards fighting voter fraud, which has been found, even by the department's criminal division, to be rare. Voter fraud is characterized by foul play on the part of the voter. DOJ action against voter suppression, which is more so characterized by foul play on the part of the state, has been much less forthcoming. Congressman John Conyers, Chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
It seems to me in recent years, instead of promoting access to the polls, the voting section of the Department of Justice seems to have used its enforcement authority to deny access and promote barriers to block legitimate voters from participating in the political process.
One case in point raised repeatedly during the hearing was the recent and controversial law in Indiana that requires voters to supply identification at the polls. In December, much to the chagrin of civil rights groups and government officials alike, the Justice Department filed an amicus brief supporting the law. In response to the issues, questions, and concerns raised by the Congress to Ashish Agarwal, the Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the DOJ's Civil Rights Division, Agarwal defended the department with phrases like, "Not that I'm aware of, I just joined the department in 2006, and I'll look into that and get back to you." In response, Minnesota Democratic Representative Keith Ellison challenged him on the constitutionality of the Indiana voter ID law in light of the poll tax amendment.
Correct.
Right. And to acquire a photographic ID would require some money, right?
Well, in Indiana, the
how
state
much does
provides
it cost?
For
how much does ID cost in Indiana?
Well, the state does have provisions for free.
I'm not asking about that. I'm asking you how much an ID costs in Indiana.
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that Indiana provides for free photo ID.
Okay, what do you have to do to get a free ID? Do you have to state your economic status to get a free ID?
No.
Do you have to state your economic status to get a free ID in Indiana?
There is an
You are the Deputy Attorney General. You should know this.
Republican Representative Mike Pence from Indiana argued for the law.
Many of us in Indiana believe that securing voter ID laws and requiring legal voters to demonstrate their identity at the polling place actually encourages participation because it gives people confidence that their vote will count and that there is fundamental integrity in the system.
Of particular note was the absence of Kenneth Blackwell, who occupied the Secretary of State's office for Ohio during the 2004 presidential elections in the midst of numerous allegations of voter disenfranchisement and corruption. Blackwell declined numerous requests from the subcommittee chairman, Congressman Gerald Nadler, to attend. Not taking no for an answer, the subcommittee voted today to allow John Conyers to subpoena his testimony. Reporting for FSRN, I'm Naji Mujahid of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Podcasts and transcripts of Free Speech Radio News can be found online at www.fsrn.org. There, listeners can also comment on the day's stories and participate in discussion forums. That's online at fsrn.org. After the significant opposition victory in last week's Pakistani election, lawyers in the country are pressing the victorious politicians to reinstate the federal judges fired by President Pervez Musharraf. Unrest among those in the legal profession was a key factor in the defeat of Musharraf's party, the Pakistan Muslim League Q. As newly elected politicians try to form a new government, lawyers are campaigning to make the restoration of an independent judiciary one of the government's first orders of business. FSRN's Tony Cross spoke with lawyers in Islamabad about the situation.
Lawyers outside Islamabad Bar Association chant slogans in support of the sacked judges. The firing of Chief Justice Iftikhar Mohammed Chowdhury last March forced them to take to the streets, where they faced tear gas and police batons. Chowdhury was later reinstated and then dismissed again. Later, when Musharraf declared a state of emergency, he sacked about 60 judges who refused to take a new oath of office. Nawaz Sharif, the leader of the Muslim League N, which came second in the election, says that the judges should be reinstated immediately. But the largest party, the People's Party, hasn't committed itself so far. Raja Alim Abbas is an ex-president of the Islamabad Bar Association. He says that he and his colleagues are keeping up the pressure.
We are of the strong belief that the judiciary should be restored. We hope that the political parties would follow the dictum of the lawyers, and if, as per the Pakistan Bar Council's and as per the lawyers' demand, they have a fixed date of 8th of March. If the parliament failed to restore the judiciary, then the lawyers' committee will take their course and will stage a long march for the restoration of the judiciary and the Chief Justice of Pakistan.
Sharif says that the judges were dismissed by an executive order issued by President Musharraf so they can be reinstated the same way, although it is unclear who would issue the order. An alternative would be to declare the firings themselves unconstitutional, but questions exist as to who would do that. Another option is for the new parliament to impeach Musharraf and declare his actions last year illegal, if two-thirds of MPs can be persuaded to back such a move. Another protesting lawyer, Malek Latif Kokar, believes that the victorious parties are just waiting to find the best method.
All parties, I hope, except the King's Party, who met with a defeat of exemplary nature, are one and the same on the point that judiciary is to be restored. But certain modalities are there. Like Nawaz Sharif says that judiciary is to be installed on the very first day. PP says that there is some other way, but all are one and the same.
Musharraf has vowed to work with the new government, but analysts say Muslim League head Sharif's call for the judges to examine the legality of the president's re-election, once they've been reinstated, might discourage him from giving them their jobs back. And the People's Party hasn't shown great enthusiasm for a showdown with the president, who still has Washington's support. So the legal profession may not be done demonstrating yet. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Islamabad.
The Burmese government announced last week that there will be a referendum in May on a new constitution. The document was drafted following the country's national convention, which was convened by hand-picked military representatives. The military junta also announced a new election will be held in 2010. But real democratic reform still seems out of reach. Opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi and several other political dissidents are still under detention. In the meantime, the junta continues to hunt those who took part in last year's uprising. More than 150 activists and monks have managed to escape to the border. FSRN's Ronald Ong Nang has more.
5 months after Buddhist monks led an uprising in Burma over increased fuel costs and state repression, the military regime continues to arrest the people who took part in the movement. Two media workers from a weekly journal were detained last week. Many others are still in hiding. Kotay Nain is the general secretary of the Assistant Association for Political Prisoners, Burma.
According to the list we have, more than 700 people are in detention after the movements in August and September. The most recent information we have says there are more than 100 monks in hiding.
Some of them fled to neighboring countries. Aung Wei is an activist and poet from Rangoon, but the interview for this story took place in a small hut within a compound of a Thai border town.
When the government cracked down on the uprising, they tried to arrest the monks, activists, and politicians. I was also on their wanted list. Then, I decided not to get arrested this time because I want to do whatever I could outside the country. So I tried to flee and I escaped.
Aung Wei was arrested and jailed 2 times before. He was a university student the first time, and the second time was after the 1988 pro-democracy uprising. Both times he was jailed for years.
After 20 years, my situation is different. I think I could not survive in prison this time. With my will to continue to fight the regime till we get democracy, I think I wouldn't have another chance to do political work if I were arrested like the last two times. And I think I might not even survive.
People who fled to border could not use normal roads as there are many checkpoints. Traveling there is not easy. Upinya Zoda is the leader of Buddhist Monk Alliance who led the September uprising. He recently reached the Thai-Burma border.
On the way, I have faced many difficulties. If I came by myself, I think I would not have escaped. Along the way, many monks and laymen helped me a lot. I didn't sleep in towns. I hid in villages along the way. I slept one night in a village. Then I took a short trip the next day. I stayed in a new village for the night, then waited for the situation to then walk again. And finally, I reached the border. It took me 7 days to reach here.
According to the Assistant Association for Political Prisoners, there are more than 150 people who have escaped across the border. A group of opposition supporters are helping them by providing food and shelter. Some are seeking protection via the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, and are looking for the chance to move to another country. But most of them have determined to stay on the border to make contact with their colleagues inside the country and prepare for the next attempt to overthrow the military regime. Upinya Zoda said their colleagues are ready to launch another protest but just waiting for the right time. And he will help them walking from the border.
Mainly, I can say that we have reached the level that, in the name of all Burma Monks Alliance, I can help my colleagues inside Burma and monks in different parts of the country. I can say we are ready now.
For FSRN, I'm Ronald Aunine in Mesot.
A new facet in the continuous tug of war India and Pakistan have over the state of Kashmir has recently emerged. The two countries are now fighting over a geographical indicator patent for a high-quality Kashmir wool called Pashmina. Shahnawaz Khan has this report.
On slopes high in the Himalaya mountains, families have for centuries bred the Pashmina goat, Capra hircus. Its fleece is painstakingly spun into yarn by Kashmiri artisans, traditionally women, before male weavers make a soft, delicate fabric known as Kashmir Pashmina. Often regarded as synonymous with Kashmir, Pashmina from Kashmir is considered the finest in the world. In August 2006, the Geographical Indicator Patent Registry, based in the South Indian city of Chennai, admitted an application from Srinagar's Craft Development Institute for a patent for Kashmir Pashmina, Sosni Embroidery and Kani Shawl, all three Pashmina-related products. A GI patent gives producers in a specified geographical region exclusive rights over a name, like the French wine and champagne makers have for their product. Mohammad Sharik Farooqi heads the Indian government-backed institute. He says Pashmina has become a generic name, with everyone claiming to produce Pashmina.
So, because of becoming generic, it is misused. So, something which is not actually of this standardized specification is also called Pashmina. So which means what is happening is that you're losing a great share of business.
But Indian efforts to get a geographical indicator patent registered for Kashmir Pashmina hit a snag with opposition from Pakistan as well as from a local body of artisans in Indian administered Kashmir. The Rawalpindi Chamber of Commerce based in Pakistan filed an objection to the patent application, insisting that fabric from its side of Kashmir has an equal claim to the name. A local body of artisans in Indian administered Kashmir also objects to the patent. The Kashmir Handmade Pashmina Promotion Trust agrees a patent is needed. However, the trust objects to how the current application was drawn up.
They had not taken into consideration that they want to make a workers' organization. It should go to workers.
Ashfaq Ahmad Muttu is the spokesman of the artisan body. Ashfaq explains that it is the yarn, ironically not included in the patent application that makes Kashmir Pashmina the finest.
Because it's only in Kashmir that yarn is spun by hand. In all other places where Pashmina is made, it is mechanized. And the quality of that yarn is so fine that sometimes a naked human eye, you cannot see it through the naked human eye. So that finer, which gives our product, it takes it to a different category altogether.
Ashfaq says a patent is essential to secure the livelihoods of the large community of weavers and spinners. Pashmina fakes and lower quality material have badly affected these artisans, who, unlike traders in the fine fabric, earn small wages even in boom times. Ghulam Muhammad Malla is a Pashmina weaver in Srinagar.
The yarn coming from Amritsar should be stopped. It is not high quality and it has resulted into a decline in our wages.
Improving the lot of artisans, Ashfaq says, is the next issue to be addressed once a patent is assigned. The CDI and the artisan body are currently engaged in negotiations over the modalities, but both reject the Pakistani application to include products from its portion of Kashmir.
See, I've seen products from Pakistan. I personally feel it doesn't have the same quality what is produced in Srinagar, for sure. We have seen things from Nepal and China, and there are much of the products which are not entirely and to majority of the process is not manual.
For the Kashmiri handicraft industry, hit by competition from inferior but cheaper products and fakes, the delay in awarding the patent only means more hardship for its traditional artisans. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Monica Lopez and Tana Gousset. Headlines editor, Nell Abram. DC editor, Leanne Caldwell. And the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Antonio Ortiz, Eric Klein, Huck Lowe, and Rose Kadhabchi. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.